welcome to the Somerset Emotional Wellbeing Podcast. My name's Dr. Andrew Tresidder from NHS Somerset, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague,
Peter Bagshaw, GP and NHS Somerset Clinical Lead for Mental Health.
And we're really pleased to welcome today another friend and colleague from NHS Somerset, Sarah Ash, and we're going to be talking about safeguarding matters. Sarah, a very warm welcome to you.
Thank you, Andrew and Peter.
And Sarah, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're doing now and how you got to be doing it and your professional background.
Well, my current job title is quite a long one. I'm the Associate Director for Safeguarding Mental Health, Learning Disability and Autism. And I sit in the Quality, Safety and Improvement Directorate under the Chief Nurse. That's not where I envisaged my career going when I started out as a student nurse back in 1989. I qualified as a general nurse and I actually worked in theatres, followed by a stint in the gynae ward. And from there, having spent some time with a health visitor when I was training, I realised that I wanted to work much more closely in the realm of public health nursing. So I was accepted onto a health visitor trainee course back in 1996 and qualified as a health visitor a year later, working in a very deprived part of Somerset where I had lots of experience of what we called in those days child protection, which is all about protecting individual children from harm. And I got a lot of experience over the next few years. I went to court, I attended lots of child protection case conferences, dealt with some quite tricky cases, was involved in one national case that hit the headlines as well. So got a lot of experience. So when an opportunity arose to become a safeguarding nurse, I applied and was successful. And I guess you could say I haven't looked back from there. I spent several years as a safeguarding nurse and as the named nurse for a variety of different organisations in Somerset as the NHS grew and evolved. And then found an opportunity in the then clinical commissioning group as something called the designated nurse for children looked after, which was a new role that I took up back in 2019. So moving very much from a provider environment into a strategic commissioning environment. And with the most recent reorganisation, I was lucky enough to be promoted to the post that I hold now. So now I have an overarching responsibility for not just safeguarding, but also professionals working in the fields of mental health, learning disability, autism, and equality, diversity, inclusion as well. So it's a really wide bag now.
So for our general listener, can you sum up in a nutshell, if they've heard the word safeguarding but don't know exactly what is safeguarding?
So it's all about looking out to our most vulnerable people. Now, the legislation is different for children compared to adults. 1989 was a key year for the children's legislation when the government recognised that the welfare of the child is paramount and that every consideration must be first and foremost about the child. Whereas in adult safeguarding, it's taken a while to catch up. Abuse of vulnerable adults has always been out there, sadly, just as has abuse of vulnerable children. But the legislation really only took off in the late 1990s and into the noughties. So we used to talk very much about vulnerable adults, but then more recently talking about adults at risk of harm. And the definition now means that any adult who has care or support needs and is at risk of or experiencing abuse needs to be safeguarded. So it's about ensuring that people are safe and well to live the best lives they can. And with adults, that's quite a wide remit because we look particularly at those vulnerable people who may live in a care home. They may have a learning disability, they may be an autistic person, they may be at risk of domestic violence. There's a really huge, sphere of vulnerabilities that we understand that adults need safeguarding for those reasons.
Really interesting, Sarah. So whose responsibility is it to work out that safeguarding, and then who actually does the safeguarding?
So safeguarding is everybody's responsibility. If you're a member of public walking down the street and you see something that concerns you, there's that overarching responsibility as a member of the public, as a member of our society and our communities, to tell somebody about that. Professionals working for so-called statutory bodies have a mandatory responsibility to tell somebody if they're concerned about somebody that they think who is at risk of harm, whether that's a child or an adult. And then you get into the more complex roles, certainly in the health service, the named and the designated roles that are statutory roles to ensure that organisations and the system themselves are carrying out their statutory responsibilities to safeguard adults and children.
So if I'm a member of the public and I come across somebody who I feel is vulnerable, or I observe something that I think might be them being taken advantage of, how do I go about raising that as a safeguarding alert? Who do I turn to?
Well, it could be 999, Peter. If there's an urgent concern for somebody's welfare, the police have the responsibility to respond. Also, our adults and children safeguarding social care services, so those services provided by the local authority. They also have a statutory duty to investigate concerns that have been raised with them about vulnerable adults and children.
And sometimes it can be really difficult, can't it? So as a GP, I might have seen somebody with learning disability or dementia, say, and I suspect that there's a family dynamic where perhaps they're being taken advantage of. But I feel very uncomfortable getting into that. Can I be reassured that if I report this, it's going to be handled sensitively?
These days, I think it's fair to say that there's more of an onus on individuals who identify concerns or potential concerns to do some of that first level gathering of information themselves. So it might be, if you're concerned about somebody, you might, as a GP or another health or care professional, ask other professionals who are involved with that person if they have any concerns, to start getting a bigger and more holistic picture. The more information that's gathered, the better, really, and certainly the better to inform the local authority, children's and adult services, who may not know, for example, a patient, a GP's patient, as well as a GP does. The more information they have in order for them to carry out their statutory requirements to investigate and assess, the better. So it really is about getting as much information as you can as quickly as possible.
And that's something, as a GP, that I think Andrew and I would both feel is our professional responsibility. But again, if we're a member of the public, then we might be quite uncomfortable trying to dig into things in more detail.
Absolutely. And we wouldn't expect members of public to do anything other than be able to identify and report to somebody, tell somebody else about it. It could equally be a family member. If they, for example, they're worried about their neighbour, they may know their neighbour's son or daughter and be able to talk to them about the concern. Obviously, if you see an assault happening in front of you, you're going to want to phone 999 because you can see that somebody's welfare is in peril at that time and you need an urgent response. I think the one of the reasons that we have historically got into trouble with safeguarding is because it is complex. There are many nuances to it. There are often many professionals and different organisations involved with vulnerable people. And so often it's the jigsaw effect. It's about joining up all of those pieces of information and making sense of the picture that it's telling us.
Thank you so much. That's really interesting. And you've mentioned what we do in a very urgent situation, but we'll put in the programme notes the other routes, certainly in Somerset, into County Council and how to take that forwards. Unless would there be any quick tips that you want to say on reporting other than through the emergency services? We'll put that in.
Well, professionals, of course, can talk to their line manager. Professionals can talk to the named and designated professionals who are the experts in the safeguarding field. They may well want to talk to colleagues as well in their own organisation or other organisations. It tends to be members of the public, doesn't it, who identify the more urgent things. And I guess their routes for conversations are more limited because they don't have those networks in place necessarily.
Thanks, Sarah. And thinking, so there are adults and there are children, and children are those who are under 18 legally. Are there any important differences between safeguarding adults and safeguarding children?
With adults, we have to think more about whether they have care or support needs. So adults are, although that's hard for some people to grasp sometimes, adults are allowed to make an unwise decision if they have capacity, whereas children, because of the paramountcy principle of the 1989 Children Act, children are always protected. Again, they have, as they get older and they understand more, we obviously listen to their voice and we want to hear the voice of the vulnerable victim, whether it's an adult or a child, and understand their wishes and feelings. But ultimately, we often need to act to safeguard children.
Sarah, you mentioned the word paramountcy, and just tell us what the paramountcy principle is.
Well, the paramountcy principle is that children, the wishes and feelings of the children, the child's needs would always come first above everybody else. So particularly when a case comes into the court arena, there will be other people's wishes and feelings to consider, like the children's parents, like the child has a social worker. They will have a view as well about what is in the best interests of the child. But ultimately, the court has to consider the child first and foremost above anything else.
And these things can be quite grey, can't they? I've been safeguarding lead in the past and I've found some quite difficult instances. So, for instance, somebody who is maybe older, maybe a few cognitive issues, and somebody knocks on the door saying, oh, your roof needs doing, and it probably doesn't. Is that something where you'd encourage members of the public to get involved, or should we stay out of things like that?
No, not at all. We should always consider with adults the risk of financial or material abuse. So somebody with some cognitive issues, there needs to be a discussion about their mental capacity and whether they have the capacity to agree, the capacity to understand what needs had to happen to the roof, and whether the bill that they're being presented with is reasonable. Because we know that there are some very unscrupulous people out there who prey on people who do have care and support needs, knowing that they are ripe for scams, for abuse.
Sarah, you've mentioned financial abuse there and scams, but are there any other sorts of abuse that we should be looking out for?
Well, the list of child abuse has not changed for a very long time. So we're talking about physical abuse, we're talking about sexual abuse, we're talking about neglect, and we're talking about emotional abuse. There are 10 definitions of adult abuse, and I've written them down so I don't forget any because I thought you might ask me this question, Andrew. So there's physical abuse, domestic violence and domestic abuse, sexual abuse, psychological and emotional abuse, financial and material abuse, modern slavery, discriminatory abuse, organizational and institutional abuse, and neglect or acts of omission, and of course self-neglect as well is another one that we consider on a daily basis.
And you mentioned modern slavery, which is something that's in the news quite a bit. But can you just remind people what that actually means?
Oh, there's been some very high profile cases, haven't there, of quite wealthy people having domestic domestic workers who have been abused and not paid properly, not been able to have a good balance of a working life and a private life, and have been abused emotionally, physically by their experiences. Modern slavery could also be, for example, a large number of people being transported to work in a factory and paying all of their wages over in transportation costs and living costs, and not seeing anything, everything being taken out of their wages at source. So being exploited in that way.
And there was another phrase that you used that I wonder if I can ask you to unpack for our listeners. So mental capacity, which is very different from the Mental Health Act, isn't it? And detaining somebody. Can you explain to people who maybe have heard the phrase but don't know exactly what it means, what are the pillars of the Mental Capacity Act?
So mental capacity fluctuates. This is the difficulty. So a lot of people with capacity issues may be able to decide what time they're going to get up in the morning, what they're going to wear, and maybe what they're going to eat for breakfast. Whereas being able to understand the example you gave earlier on, Peter, being able to understand the intricacies of a builder's quote for work to their house, they may not have the capacity to understand that. They may not have the capacity to understand the need for taking medication, for example. And of course, we also know that capacity can fluctuate, which is why it's so important that when we're considering people making a decision about themselves, that we assess their capacity, and that we do that in a multi-agency way as well. And that actually, if we deem somebody doesn't have capacity to make a specific decision, then it is around the professionals, around the professional network around that person, making a decision that's in their best interest, so that we get the right decisions for vulnerable people.
Sarah, really important to talk about capacity, because a person to make a capacitated decision under the Mental Capacity Act, they have to understand the issue, they have the information presented, they have to be able to weigh or retain it, and then they have to, in the end, be able to communicate that decision. So one may actually understand it, but if you can't communicate it, then that's difficult. And also, although there's a presumption of capacity, it is presumed that people have capacity, even if they've got an impairment of mind, actually, if you have got capacity, you are allowed to make unwise decisions, even though people might think that's not a good idea. So it's really quite complicated, isn't it? Especially as you were mentioning, each decision can or cannot have capacity. So you may have capacity to choose what you want to eat and where you want to go, but not to pay complex bills or make investments or difficult things like that. Sarah, can you give us an example of something that's been really interesting and commonplace that's happened over the last 2 or 3 years for you in this safeguarding area?
Well, one of the things I never thought I would be involved in again, moving into the Clinical Commissioning Group and then ICB, was in any litigation. But coming up for 3 years ago now, we discovered that our adoption processes were not compliant with legislation. So we were requested to attend court to explain what had happened and what we were doing about it, which led to a complete root and branch review of our adoption services in Somerset. And cut a very long story short, we've come out the other side of that with a much better invested and now well understood service for children whose plan of care is adoption. The legislation for adoption, as with lots of pieces of legislation, is quite complex. The role of the medical advisor for adoption is complex and little known. Which is how we managed to get into trouble in the first place. But I'm really proud of how all of the professionals have worked together to change that and improve the service that we've got now. We used to have a situation in Somerset where children were waiting a long time for a medical assessment by an adoption medical advisor. We have no waiting list now. We are really assured now that the service that's in place is providing a robust assessment service for children, which results in the children's potential adopters having a really clear understanding of their health needs now and what those health needs may look like in the future. So it's been a really positive, expensive, but positive piece of work.
That's really interesting, Sarah. And I have some insights into one or two little bits of that. And I can assure all our listeners that nobody has been harmed by anything that's happened in the past. Everything has been, all professionals have been working appropriately, but the mechanisms of the process were not perhaps as crossed as T's and dotted as I's as they should have been. I think the judge would probably say that there was a little bit of dotting of I's that, or quite a lot of dotting of I's that needed doing. Would that be fair to say, Sarah?
That would be fair to say, Andrew. And I think the big benefit of what was a very hard and difficult piece of work, that the benefits of it was that we have been able to advise and inform our colleagues, not just locally, but across the region and also across the country, to the difficulties that we had in Somerset. Through the court case, it became apparent that other areas had similar problems to Somerset and either had not identified it or did not think that it was a great concern. So I really feel that piece of work has had a lot of influence on the national system. And I guess for me, that is what safeguarding in the ICB particularly looks like, that ability to understand things strategically and look at how you can influence the development of health services. So our health services are high quality and safe, but they also safeguard our most vulnerable people. And clearly, I'm sure your listeners would agree that children who have a care plan for adoption are one of our most vulnerable groups, because actually, making a court order to separate a child from their biological parents is one of the worst things actually a court can do. So I think being able to make sure that process is as safe, robust and high quality as possible has been a great piece of work to achieve.
I think it's brilliant that you work in this field and that you're so positive about it. Having been involved in it in a small way myself, I found it a very, very scary area, because often you're making decisions that aren't black and white, and they're often very high stakes, whether it's because of legal things or because of the impact on the family. Does it keep you awake at night?
Sometimes it does, Peter, yes, because it is a huge responsibility. And I guess for me, one of the things that I can do for other people who are working in that field as well is be able to provide that support and that understanding. And I think through the work that myself and my team do, we provide a lot of support to the wider system in Somerset and again across the region and sometimes nationally, and it's a great privilege to be able to provide that. And I think going back to my roots as a safeguarding children nurse, that the role I carried out in providing clinical supervision to groups of people who were working very much on the front line of the NHS in order to support them to make the right decisions and to stop them being awake at night was great. I really enjoyed that work. I really enjoy even now being able to work alongside professionals, because the beauty of this job and the beauty of the roles that the people in my team carry out is that one minute we could be commenting on a national policy or consultation for new legislation, but the next minute we could actually be talking to somebody in our system about a live safeguarding case for somebody who needs advice to help them unpick. And you're absolutely right, these are very, very tricky situations. They're very rarely black and white. There's very rarely just one right answer. And at the middle of it, you have to keep in sight the vulnerable person, that if you do the wrong thing, you could put them at more risk of harm as opposed to safeguarding them.
Sarah, as a friend and colleague in the ICS, it's a privilege to work alongside you. And just going briefly back to the court case, I know from observing you how many hundreds and hundreds of hours of work that you put in onto that. So on behalf of the people of Somerset, you know, thank you for all you're doing at a high level and caring about the individuals, at the, which is what it's all about. Peter, is there anything else you wanted to say?
No, I think you've brought it back. Absolutely, Andrew. It's all about caring, isn't it? And it's nice to know that there are people such as yourselves willing to take on these difficult roles and act in the best interests of the person, even if it does cost you some sleepless nights. So thank you.
thank you so much, Sarah. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Go well.
You've been listening to the Somerset Emotional Wellbeing Podcast. The show was hosted by our team of doctors, including Dr. Andrew Tresidder, Dr. Peter Bagshaw, and Dr. Sarah Coop. The show was produced by Rob Huns Music on behalf of the NHS Somerset Integrated Care Board.